from KQED.
We're going to turn our attention, as promised, to impeachment. A group of House Republicans disrupted a closed-door impeachment hearing just yesterday, delaying testimony from a Pentagon official overseeing Ukraine policy. And the demonstration came on the heels of Tuesday's explosive testimony from William Taylor, former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, who recounted, quote, irregular informal channels, end quote, that were used by the Trump White House to conduct foreign policy. Meanwhile, in a New York courtroom yesterday, Donald Trump's legal team argued that Trump cannot be the subject of any criminal investigation or prosecution while he is in office. And we're going to talk about the latest developments in the inquiry and where it's headed. Joining us is Kimberly Atkins, senior national news correspondent for WBUR in Boston. Glad to have you with us this morning. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And also, we welcome Scott R. Anderson, fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. Scott Anderson, thank you for being a part of this program.
Thank you.
And what questions do you, our listeners, have about the status of the impeachment inquiry and the testimony we've heard so far, or about the Republicans' efforts to storm the hearing? You can give us a call right now, and we invite you to do that. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. That number again, 866-733-6786. And you can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum at kqed.org. And Kimberly Atkins, let me begin with you, and let's sort of trace out what actually happened yesterday with respect to Republican legislators storming a deposition safe place that was closed door. And we've seen closed door depositions being given in the past with just committee members. And they were yelling that this all had to be out in the open, I guess, maybe trying to flex muscles the way perhaps Brett Kavanaugh did.
Yeah, so what has been happening, and just to give a little bit of background, the president has repeatedly said in public and on Twitter that he was unhappy with the Republicans for the way that they have been responding to the ongoing impeachment hearing, saying that they have not been, quote-unquote, tough enough in his estimation. So after those comments, we saw yesterday a group of several dozen Republicans go and essentially storm a SCIF. A SCIF is a secure area where things like depositions or other hearings are held when they involve security, national security issues. Cell phones aren't allowed. They're very secured in order to prevent that information from leaking out. These members stormed in and prevented the deposition of a Defense Department official for several hours. The Republicans said that they didn't like the fact that these were being held as so-called secret hearings. They call these hearings secret, that they're being conducted by the Democrats only. Of course, that isn't true. There are three committees who are allowed access to this secure area. It is bipartisan. It's just as nearly as many Republicans as there are Democrats, but it was seen largely just by everybody who I spoke to yesterday as a stunt to try to gain attention. There was a hope that perhaps there would be some confrontation with security. One lawmaker, Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch, really cautioned against getting security involved because he didn't want to give them that moment. So it was a matter of drama, a dramatic inflection point in these impeachment hearings as they go forward, and the president and those who support him grow increasingly unhappy about it.
And I think we should mention that this was led by Florida's Matt Gaetz and Louisiana's Steve Scalise, and also that Laura Cooper was the one who was giving testimony, Deputy Secretary of Defense for Ukraine, Russia, and Eurasia. And there was testimony, some rather dramatic testimony, and let me go to you on this, Scott Anderson, that was offered by William Taylor. And at this point, despite the fact that he's a 40-year veteran of not only Democrat but Republican administrations, there's been an attempt to essentially sully his name. But this was testimony that really came out tied to the narrative of quid pro quo, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Ambassador Taylor testified the day before this kind of march into the SCIF. And what he basically laid out is his experience as the chargé d'affaires, meaning kind of the senior official at the U.S. Embassy in Kiev from June, when he was brought in to replace the kind of ousted ambassador, Marie Yovanovitch. from to the present. And what he described is the existence of what he calls an irregular channel of foreign policy making within the Trump administration, composed of a number of people who he described as being politically connected but were separate from the usual policy making channel. This included U.S. Special Envoy to Ukraine, or for Ukraine, I should say, Kurt Volker. It included Gordon Sondland, who's the U.S. Ambassador to the European Union. And this separate irregular channel was really being driven by a policy agenda that Taylor attributed to Rudolf Giuliani, the president's lawyer, of course, private lawyer, I should say. And what he describes is this channel increasingly putting pressure to make certain deliverables to the Ukrainian president, in particular, initially a White House meeting and later security assistance, contingent upon an announcement, and particularly a public announcement, by the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, insisting that they are opening an investigation into 2016 election interference that President Trump and his supporters maintained was orchestrated in opposition to his candidacy, in addition to announcement into investigations into Burisma, a natural gas company that's associated with Hunter Biden, and broader investigation into the Bidens as well. And this sort of conditionality, Taylor draws out how it was done, presented fairly expressly, at least according to his account, by a number of officials, particularly Ambassador Sondland, who in his narrative plays a fairly central role in this. That's a little bit in tension with what Sondland testified to a few days ago, which he played himself a little bit more of a bit part. But regardless, according to Taylor, Sondland played this sort of orchestrating role and importantly relayed to him several directives from President Trump himself, where President Trump reportedly claimed that he wanted to put Zelensky in a public box by forcing him to make this public commitment to launch investigations, and that he made everything, quote, everything, as Taylor said it, which he understood, Taylor understood to mean security assistance as well as a White House meeting, as well as anything else, contingent upon making this sort of public statement. And so it gives this window into the insight and motivations of the different actors involved from the perspective of Taylor, somebody who was on all of these calls, who was a witness to it, who often spoke out in the moment about concerns he had about that process. And importantly, it ties those motivations and actions directly to the president. It very clearly describes him, even as he says and repeats this mantra that has become part of his defense, no quid pro quo. Every time Taylor describes him doing that, he makes clear that Trump is, in fact, demanding a quid pro quo. And in that way, it's a very damaging piece of testimony.
And again, Scott R. Anderson is a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. Kimberly Atkins is senior national news correspondent for WBUR. And I'm wondering, Kimberly Atkins, if you have some thoughts about testimony that also came out in the New York courtroom. And it came out to the extent that the president's lawyers saying the president can't be charged. I mean, we were hearing can't be investigated. Excuse me. We were hearing that kind of argument. I mentioned charged because it was a little Freudian slip thinking about the attorney general, and particularly when he was talking about the Mueller report. But this seems to be mounting a campaign that will head into impeachment, perhaps.
Yes. So this is a fight over disclosure of the president's tax returns and the president's attorneys. Now, this is an argument that's being made by his attorneys. It has not been adopted, but essentially extends, as you said, the claims that the president and his team made during the Mueller investigation, which is that the president can't be charged with any crime. The attorneys yesterday in New York took it a step further, saying that he can't even be investigated while he's still in office, that once he is out of office, things are completely different. But as of right now, that he cannot be investigated at this point. And it goes right back to it harkens back to on the campaign trail when President Trump said he could stand on Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and he would still not lose any support from the voters who backed him. It seems to be this overarching theme from the president, his attorney, and his administration that he can't be touched right now, especially as these separate – keep in mind, this is one of several investigations into President Trump, either personally or the Trump Organization, that continue to go on, separate from the impeachment inquiry, which is focused on the Ukraine call that Scott laid out so well. And so it just seems to be a number of legal issues that are mounting against the president, and in all of them, they're claiming essentially that the president acted properly, and even if he didn't, there's really nothing that Congress or the courts can do about it.
And what about future testimony? Scott, let me go to you on this. I mean, there's certainly going to be attempts to bring Rudy Giuliani in to testify, as well as Mike Pompeo and, for that matter, Rick Perry or Vice President Pence. And there's all this denial of coming in to testify by all those figures and more figures, and yet we've got more testimony to come.
That's absolutely right. It's a pretty remarkable series of events in a lot of different ways, because we're seeing a number of State Department so far, although now, as of yesterday, a Defense Department official, potentially others coming forward and testifying before Congress, in spite of the fact that the White House has said that they refuse to cooperate with this inquiry, and often over, at least according to reports, the objections by the State Department and, in yesterday's case, the Defense Department. And this is pretty notable that they're coming forward and giving this testimony. We don't 100% know exactly what the kind of legal calculus that they're applying or the exchange is with these departments about these issues. But what we do know is that there's no legal prohibition against these employees coming up and testifying, at least insofar as they don't accidentally disclose classified information to someone who's not allowed to hear it. What there is a possibility of is that there can be career repercussions. There can be negative personnel actions that can be taken. But there are statutes that Congress has put in place to protect federal employees from that, particularly the Whistleblowers Protection Act, which basically says disclosures of information relating to misconduct or crimes or illegal conduct are protected from any sort of negative personnel action. So if any of these employees were to experience a negative personnel action, meaning a demotion or being fired or even being denied a promotion that they feel they're qualified for, they could launch a challenge with the Merit Service Protection Board, and then they would be able to say, well, I think this is being happening to me as a reprisal for my disclosure that is protected by this law. That appears to be a degree of protection for these employees that's making them perhaps more willing to make this sort of testimony. Now, some of these employees have quit. Some of them are senior enough that there's not really any realistic career repercussions that will come to them. That's not true of all of them. But many of them are taking the brave step of, despite the objections of their superiors, coming forward, testifying in a way that is legal, that doesn't infringe upon any clear national security equities, at least as far as we're aware thus far, and is going to be putting their career on the protections that are provided to them by the law. That is, again, a pretty exceptional pattern. Usually, this sort of testimony is coordinated by officials within each department. But I think in this case, essentially, these employees are saying, I'm going to comply and cooperate with this inquiry, which I think is appropriate, even if other people in my department feel that is not.
I have to jump in here because I want to again invite listeners to join us. In fact, you can do that now. We're talking to Scott Anderson and Kimberly Atkins and want to hear from you. If you have some thoughts about the impeachment hearings disrupted yesterday by Republican representatives as the inquiry intensifies, we want to hear from you. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. You can also join us, of course, by emailing us forum@kqed.org or getting in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. And again, we're at KQED Forum. Stay tuned for more. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Kimberly Atkins, who is senior correspondent for WBUR and former chief Washington reporter and columnist with the Boston Herald, and Scott Anderson, a fellow in governance studies with the Brookings Institution and senior fellow in the National Security Law Program at Columbia Law School, also senior editor and counsel with Lawfare. And with all your legal background, Scott, I'm going to go first to you on this question from a listener named Joel, who wants to know, what's the legal and procedural basis for Democrats conducting closed-door hearings or depositions? Is there any reason to be concerned that it's improper? Would Democrats object if the roles were reversed? I'm sorry, Scott, I'm thinking immediately of Benghazi, which had closed-door hearings, but let's get a response from you about the legal side of this.
I mean, that's a great example. The closed-door hearing that we see taking place in these inquiries actually is far from a regular procedure. It's something that happens pretty often when you're investigating, or I should say when Congress is investigating topics that have national security implications, simply because you're hearing testimony from officials where they may touch on sensitive issues, maybe classified issues, maybe not classified but still sensitive. And so there's an effort to install a level of protection for sort of government secrets, essentially, or other sensitive information, and to insulate it before bringing it out public. It's a pretty standard procedure. And as we've already heard, it is one in which Republicans and Democrats have fairly equal roles. Again, the meetings are being held with representation from the Republicans on these committees. They are the Republicans who the Republican leadership appointed to these committees. And these are rules that have been in place since the Republicans were in the majority. And they used them in the Benghazi hearing, among many other contexts, as Democrats have used them in other contexts. So it is a very normal procedure. And it's not particularly exceptional in any regard. Now, also in this point, it's worth noting that—
Also, could I make note of the fact, excuse me, Scott, that as Kimberly pointed out before, there were Republicans on these committees who were in the closed-door hearings.
Oh, that's exactly right. You know, each of these committees is composed of about half Republicans and about half Democrats, because that's the ratio of the House, slightly less than half Republicans in each case. And not only are they present, they are allowed to present questions. They are allowed to make opening statements. They have been allowed to interrogate every one of these witnesses. And the people heading these investigations have been very clear that they intend to release parts of these transcripts. There may be cases where there are, again, these secrets that get involved that they may feel a need to redact or strike. But in the instance, they want to release them at a certain point, but they at first need to have the sorts of hearings so they can get all the facts on board before bringing it out to the public. And one other there's another real tension here, too, with the White House is saying, with how House Republicans are saying. The White House has said, we don't want this testimony from going forward because of executive privilege, because we're worried these witnesses are going to get into sensitive government secrets. Yet their allies in the House, among the House of Representatives, are objecting to the secret nature of these hearings, which are being conducted that way precisely to protect those same secrets, to prevent them from becoming too public too soon, to give an opportunity to pull those secrets out of anything before it goes public. Those positions aren't reconcilable. If anything, you would think the Trump administration would appreciate that these are being done in a way to protect those information privileges that they're concerned about supposedly being made public. Yet that's not the position they're adopting.
And Kimberly Atkins, let me just go back to you for a moment, because the Trump administration is still coming out with these broadsides that what they were doing vis-a-vis Ukraine was fighting corruption. And this is a hard one to swallow, particularly since I can't visualize any other country where the Trump administration felt it was necessary to fight corruption. But also money was, I believe, and you can confirm this, if I think the Trump administration has actually cut the funding to so-called fighting corruption in Ukraine specifically.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that is what national security experts I've been talking to this week have pointed out, that the Trump administration has moved away as part of its policy in allocating funding for things like fighting corruption, that there's no other incidents or evidence of other corruption that this administration is specifically looking to. So it runs completely counter to its narrative in explaining why they were seeking to put any pressure on Ukraine in exchange for this congressionally allocated military funding. And so that is a key difference here between the two.
And we'll bring a caller aboard here. James, you're on with us. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Sorry about the train horn in the background. I would like to bring back up the issue of Deutsche Bank. I know that President Trump inflated his wealth to the financial institution, from my understanding, with bank fraud. And at the time at which it was made light, Deutsche Bank was more than happy to cooperate with investigators. So I'm just curious on where we are on that.
Where are we on Deutsche Bank? Kimberly Atkins.
Yeah, you know, there are honestly so many investigations going on simultaneously to this impeachment inquiry.
It's a whirligig. You have to kind of
try
to stay up with them day to day, moment to moment.
It really is. And so there are investigations that are going on into the financial dealings of President Trump, of the Trump Organization. They're taking place we saw some of that was revealed, or some of it hit upon during the Mueller investigation. But they still continue to go on in courtrooms in New York and elsewhere. So it's a smorgasbord of legal trouble that the president is facing as he is also fending off an impeachment inquiry.
I'm going to read a comment from a listener named Carl, who writes, these hard-knuckle tactics are designed as theater to discredit and disrupt the hearings and take the focus off of the actual illegal facts that are coming to light. And Scott Anderson, let me go to you with a question from a listener named Alex, who says, Republicans realize that their leaders' actions have been unconstitutional, illegal, and impeachable, and all they have left as name-calling and dangerous criminal disruption of the legal process. Every one of those who illegally entered and put classified information at risk should be permanently denied security clearances. What do you think the chances are, Scott, of or the likelihood of consequences for these actions?
That's a very good question. And I think there's a possibility of some largely rhetorical consequences. You know, the House, I think, may very well, adopt a resolution that possibly along partisan lines that condemns some of the activity, maybe censures them, maybe refers them for internal investigations. It's interesting that individual members of Congress actually don't get security clearances. They are kind of presumptively assumed to be secure so they can share information with them. And then only the ones on these committees usually have access to the gifts to receive that classified information. So there is not so much a formal classification as a more of a structure through which that information flows.
Yeah, but I have another listener. Excuse me, Scott. Another listener wants to know if they were taking any videos, for example, potentially revealing methods to our nation's enemies.
It's possible. I spent a good amount of my time in SCIFs, and so videos, aren't going to be that useful because they look a lot like conference rooms, sometimes with strange panels on the walls, and that's about it. So I'm not sure video is particularly concerning. Certainly, there would be concern if there were audio devices left behind. And my understanding is that you had congressional staff, congressional personnel doing security sweeps of the chamber to ensure nothing like that happened after the protesters finally left.
There's another caller joining us. So that's you, Kim. You're on the air. Good morning. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I work for the military, and I have to say these kind of this PR stunt that these Republican congressmen pulled yesterday and the general disregard of people in the Trump administration around security clearances is really discouraging, I think, and sets a really bad example for the hundreds of thousands of people who work in the military and other people who work in the government. And we have to go. We're constantly trained in following security procedures and get security clearances. And we have to be incredibly careful down to the last detail not to make a slip up. Even if we don't understand what the rules are for, we know it's important. And to see these people higher up in the government just completely disregarding these security procedures it can't be setting a good example for people who work for the military day to day and people who are responsible for I feel like it could, this kind of thing, if it becomes more generally widespread, it could actually be putting American troops in danger when our higher ups are just breaking the rules like this. So I think it's not just a matter of, it was a PR stunt and about impeachment, but it's really about the general respect and people at the top following the rules and procedures so that people lower down are also going to do the same thing.
Kim, I appreciate your perspective, and thank you very much for that call. And I'm going to go to a comment before I go to another caller with a question embedded in it. Let me go back to you, if I may, Kimberly Atkins. Rachel wants to know, is it true that, one, over 50 Republican members are on the three investigating committees, and two, the rule change that doesn't allow them to cross-examine was made under President Obama by the Republicans?
Yes, so it is. I believe the count is 47 Republicans that sit on these committees who do have access to the SCIF. I'm also told by staffers on the Hill that generally speaking, with most of these depositions and hearings that are taking place in these secure facilities, usually you only get about half of the Republicans on these committees that show up on a regular basis. So not only do they have access to it, they often don't take advantage of it. And I forgotten the second half part of the question already. I apologize.
No, that's okay. Wanted to know if the failure to or the disallowing of cross-examination came under the Obama administration by Republicans.
Yes, yes. And these are the rules that are set. And this goes directly to an earlier question about the process and what is right and is this really a secret proceeding. When it comes to conducting this type of investigation by the House, the rules are made by the House, by the members who are in power, and right now the Democrats are. There is no requirement that these hearings be conducted in public. There isn't even a requirement that there be a formal vote. I know there was a lot of talk about that. There's been no vote to start an impeachment inquiry. In the past, if you think about it, with the Clinton impeachment, for example, there was a special prosecutor. There was Ken Starr, who conducted a host of investigations privately, secretly. This just seems different because it's being done by House members and not by some independent person. But this is the way that they chose to do it. They have that right. The Constitution gives them really broad berth to set the rules as to procedure how this moves forward.
I think it's also maybe axiomatic, Scott Anderson, that it's intemperate of a president of the United States with an impeachment inquiry to say this is a lynching, which he did publicly, but also the indication from the president that he's not getting due process. I mean, what does this have to do with due process? Nothing, does it?
Not particularly, no. You have to put this in the context of what role we're at in the impeachment inquiry. What happens is that the House adopts articles of impeachment by a majority, and that essentially functions as an indictment. And much like before a grand jury in the United States, that's not a two-party process. It is a party by which the government, or in this case, those favoring the articles of impeachment in the House, come forward, they make the case, and they adopt, in the case of a grand jury, with a grand jury support, in this case with support from the majority of the House, kind of the charges, the allegations. In the past, there have been, you know, some negotiated terms about saying there's some opportunities to question certain witnesses or getting certain information in. And frankly, we haven't seen any specific requests for those sorts of minor concessions from the Trump administration. Instead, we've seen this broad dismissal of this as somehow violative of constitutional principles that, frankly, have never applied previously in this context in the way that they claim they do, and then the refusal to participate in any sort of way. Regardless, once these articles of impeachment, if they are, and once they are adopted by the House, the matter then goes to the Senate, where there is a more formal trial, where there are procedures in place by which you have different perspectives presented and opportunities to argue over whether or not this should result in conviction and result in certain consequences, particularly removal from office and potentially a ban on future office.
And presided over by the Chief Justice, Roberts, we should mention.
Precisely right, presided over by the Chief Justice, and something that looks a lot more like a trial, which is where we usually think of the sorts of due process rights that the Trump administration is insisting on. So they're trying to bring those back to an earlier stage where, frankly, they really haven't existed in the way that they're insisting they have before. And it's, frankly, primarily a means of distractions and of trying to build support for what is a pretty unprecedented constitutional action of simply not cooperating with Congress on what, by all appearances, appears to be a legitimate and valid investigation.
And as one of our listeners, Paul, points out, I think a salient point, he says, I think the primary rationale for taking testimony in secret is to prevent coordination with future witnesses. Let me bring another caller aboard. Steve, that's you. Join us.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to get a take on this OLC opinion. It just seems like it's clogging up the whole system. And I'm wondering why just an opinion has so much weight.
You want to weigh in here, Kimberly Atkins?
Sure. I think he's referring to the opinion that a president cannot be prosecuted while in office.
Well, we started with earlier on in the conversation. Yeah. Exactly.
Yes. And these opinions are made, they're advisory opinions for within the Department of Justice. So they're not like a law or a court ruling, but it is the opinion of the Office of Legal Counsel that is designed to give prosecutors guidance. And there are lots of OLC opinions like this. And this one was relied on heavily during the Mueller report. Of course, at any point, the Department of Justice, the OLC, may change their mind and issue a different opinion. There is also a number of Democratic candidates for president have proposed codifying, introducing a law that would specifically state that a president can be prosecuted while in office. So it's an advisory committee. It was certainly relied on heavily by the Trump administration here, but it is not as permanent as a law or a ruling from a court.
And again, Kimberly Atkins is senior correspondent with WBUR. I'm going to read a couple of comments from you, our listeners. The listener writes, I am not a supporter of the president, but I would be angry if after holding secure depositions, the Democrats spoke in public after each day's testimony. Something more helpful would be a statement of who was deposed, what questions were asked, and a statement signed by majority and minority committee chairs as to substance. The last thing we need is even a whiff of unfairness, which feeds paranoia. And Dave writes, when they are in the majority, the Republicans routinely lock the Democrats out of committee work and procedural decisions. This is nothing more than a fairly small dose of their own medicine. And here's Jim. Jim, join us. Welcome.
Hello. Yes. I'm just wondering why this whole investigation is necessary. There seems to have been more than sufficient high crimes and misdemeanors, as outlined in the Constitution, to proceed with an impeachment hearing on this gentleman. Beyond what, why are they needing adding facts to this whole thing?
I think it gets down, let me go to you again, Kimberly Atkins, to focus on Ukraine and the phone call, the infamous phone call back in July with the president of Ukraine. But there are many other, as you said earlier, investigations going on simultaneously now.
And when it comes to the Ukraine testimony, Speaker Nancy Pelosi has been really clear that they want to be thorough. They're not operating so much under a timeline as they are under a desire to make sure that they have all the facts, as she says, repeatedly. But that being said, Democrats now are indicating that at least the public hearings on this will be taking place in a matter of weeks, with a hope to wrap up the investigation by the end of the year. So when you think about, generally speaking, any sort of impeachment inquiry, this one surrounding the Ukraine situation has been moving at a fairly fast speed. And of course, there are political realities in place. That is the reason for that. You have an election coming up next year, and they're trying as much as they can to get this wrapped up before at least the early primaries begin. And so that's what's pushing this. So I think you will see things happening a lot more quickly while all these other investigations also continue to move through, for involving the president, also involving other people like his counsel, Rudolph Giuliani, is being investigated too as part of this Ukrainian probe that could result in him facing charges as well.
And we should mention that the Democrats said they will have open hearings after the depositions and may complete transcripts available. In fact, California Congressman Ted Lieu has said publicly that that will be the case. Let me thank Jim for his call, and let me bring on more callers. Let me go next to you, John. John, join us.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, so I wanted to really first say I really appreciate the nuanced conversation you guys are having about this issue. And I just want to add a little bit of context. I grew up in Matt Gaetz's district, but I've been here for about 4.5 years. But I've had to be painfully aware of this congressperson who led the quote unquote storming of the session. And I just wanted to say that the political environment that this congressperson lives in, it is not nuanced like you all are participating in. And so I see the effort going into really sussing out the details of all this, but the conversation that's happening in this person's home district is very blunt and very vapid. So I just want to offer that little bit of context, because that is really what you're dealing with. You're dealing with people who are leading this lapdog behavior for Trump that don't have the level of discussion that you're having right now. And I will take my comment off air. And again, I appreciate it.
Well, John, I appreciate that perspective from the Floridian view, and I thank you for that call. Actually, I want to go back, if I may, Scott Anderson, to you, and let's get some sense from you of where the inquiry is going to be headed now and what the trajectory is.
Sure. I mean, as far as we can tell, it looks like we're slowly getting to the stage, or perhaps not so slowly, we're somewhat rapidly getting to the stage of ending these closed testimony. We're then going to hear a period of open testimony, I think, as soon as mid-November, to be rumored, where we'll hear some of these witnesses come back up again and give a public version of their testimony. And then we presume they're going to go into a process where they're going to start writing articles of impeachment. There is some talk about getting that done around Thanksgiving. I suspect it will take a little bit longer. And then the House is going to vote. vote on them. Again, a simple majority step. Once the House adopts, and if it adopts, articles of impeachment, those then go to the Senate. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has already said that if we get articles of impeachment, we're going to have a trial. It's not clear exactly what that entails. There may be ways that he can make it a mini trial or a bit of a show trial. But with Chief Justice Roberts' involvement, that may be difficult, or hopefully will be difficult at least. And then we're going to go on to see this more adversarial, more trial-like procedure with presentation of both sides that then goes to a vote to the Senate. The Senate requires two-thirds vote to actually take any action against Trump, to remove him from office or to bar him from holding future office and or. Those are the kind of two remedies available. And so it doesn't seem likely that that's going to be the outcome. But it's possible. But it doesn't seem terribly likely given the strong support that the president maintains among many Republicans, including Republicans in the Senate.
Let me read a tweet here, if I may. Excuse me, Scott, for interrupting, please. But I'm looking at a tweet from a listener. It says, how can the public trust that a fair impeachment trial will occur in the Senate when Republican senators have already come out against it?
We do have essentially a commitment by the Senate Majority Leader that says that I'm going to have to hold this trial. And it's not clear procedurally he can avoid it because some of these issues are resolved through a process that's a more of a majority vote than the sort of two-thirds that's normally required in the Senate that essentially may allow a simple majority, meaning Democrats with maybe just a handful of Republicans like Senator Romney and a few other people who have been critical of the president, maybe more open to an impeachment trial, to proceed. And, you know, I think at this point, having made that commitment, it's going to be difficult for him to walk back. So I think we're going to see something like a trial. It may be very short. It may be very summary. It may lead to a Republican majority or even a Republican minority, but above the one-third threshold that necessary to shut it down, ending it fairly quickly. But I think we're going to see something come out of it in the Senate.
And we'll bring another caller aboard. Mick, that's you. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, Michael, Kimberly, and Scott. Thank you all for taking my call. I just wanted to emphasize 2 points this morning. You know, one is just the very, very secure nature of a SCIF. You know, for listeners not aware, that stands for Secure Compartmentalized Information Facility. And, you know, essentially it's one of those places where it's been specially designated by our, you know, military and intelligence kind of apparatus that this is the most secure place for documents relevant to national security. And things should not be leaving that or unauthorized, you know, entering into that space because it is so secretive and so sensitive to national security. And, you know, I think that's a point that maybe, you know, we've been glossing over it a little bit, but I wanted to reemphasize that again. And kind of as a secondary to that as well, I really think that, you know, it's one of those things where me as a, you know, average citizen and our House representatives are essentially average citizens that are just representing their district. It's a federal crime for me to unauthorize, you know, access a SCIF. And I would go to jail for, you know, 6 months to a year. And that's like a federal statute that's very, very cut and dry. And for, you know, members of, you know, the House of Representatives who access the SCIF in this unauthorized manner, you know, are they above the law? Are they not kind of subject to the same rules and regulations that we are as, you know, the average citizen?
Thank you for those points, Mick. And Kimberly Atkins, are the Democrats going to press on that, do you think?
Yes, it looks like not. Congressman Lynch and others said yesterday one concern about having security remove them or press any sort of matter like that is that it would be giving Republicans exactly what they want, which is, you know, this to say, look how badly the Democrats are obstructing us. They're even arresting us because they don't want to have due process. They don't want to give them that talking point. So politically, while it, legally that might be an option, politically it really isn't. And also to the point about impeachment that the previous caller had, the political realities in the Senate is that, by and large, the president has really strong support in the Senate, so the likelihood that there will be a vote to remove him are small. However, I have a piece out today that looks at Mitt Romney, for example, a senator from Utah, former Massachusetts governor, who has been increasingly vocally critical of Donald Trump. Eyes are on him to see if he can convince maybe even a few Republicans to look at this with at least more of an open mind and not be predetermined in their outcome. But we'll have to wait and see.
But as some have pointed out, Mitt Romney is in a very, shall we say, anomalous position. He's got a very safe seat, and he's got it for right through till that Senate's term is over of his. I'm wondering, though, what you think, Kimberly, about just some kind of penalties for those who are denying these congressional subpoenas. I mean, is there anything other than fines or possibly some have even said they should be arrested?
Well, it depends on certainly once a more formal vote on impeachment has taken place, the House can impose greater penalties and really go at that point, go to court and try to enforce these things. And in that case, there can be fines, there can be penalties, there could even be jail time for refusing that. But again, I think at the moment, the priority of House Democrats is to move quickly, and going to court can take a long time. And I think that's why you haven't seen as much of that happening. They're just moving forward, and any effort that they see to stop or interfere with the process could just lead to another article of impeachment for obstruction of justice.
I want to read a comment from a listener named Scott, a former Foreign Service officer, who says, I am a retired Foreign Service officer who finished a 32-year career with the State Department 5 years ago. I work with the individuals who have been testifying in recent days, and I can fully confirm that they are diplomats of the highest integrity. There is a deep ethos of nonpartisanship within the Foreign Service. We'll conclude with that comment. Kimberly Atkins, thank you so much for joining us. Good to have you with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And Scott Anderson, thank you so much again for being with us as well. Good to have you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you, our listeners. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. When we return in the hour ahead, we're going to spend some time with Gail Collins, who is, of course, columnist of the New York Times and who has authored a book called No Stopping Us Now, The Adventures of Older Women in American History. It's a whole social history, but we'll also talk with her about politics because that's something she regularly covers, as those of you who know and appreciate her column. And KQED Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, and Grace Wu, and our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Ariana Prell. Ariana Prell is actually now one of our producers. We're delighted to have her. And our interns are Caroline Smith. We get support from Amanda Fon. Our interns are Caroline Smith and Sam Klein-Markman. Executive editor is Ethan Lindsay. Chief content officer is Holly Kernan. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. Stay tuned for another hour. Right up ahead, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.